Okay, good morning everybody. Thank you very much for coming.
It's good to see some new faces. It's good to see some old faces. If everybody has a source sheet, that would be good. New old faces, as it were. If you could please remember to turn off your telephones, put them on silent or something like that. I would like to thank the sponsors. We have two sponsorships today. The Shurim for the whole year are sponsored by an anonymous sponsor, Nishmoy Sprana Basbrandit and Zeli Ben Kalman. Very grateful, as always, for that sponsorship. And today's specific shir is sponsored by Mrs. Vivian Brachfeld in loving memory of her brother, Menachem Ben Avram Yehuda, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, on his yahrzeit, which is the 12th of Iyar. So thank you very, very much. Is Mrs. Brachfeld here? Don't know if she's here, but maybe she may be listening. But thank you very, very much for the sponsorship. Much appreciated. Okay, we move on to Pastor's News. We talked last time a little bit about the Israeli flag, which I found a very interesting topic to research. What I'd like to do now is move into an area which will have very specific applications, but today we're going to lay the foundations. So when I was a law student back in the old days, in the 1980s, I studied law at Oxford, and Oxford, of course, has to be higher brow than everybody else, or at least they think they have to. And they don't call their law degree law. They call their law degree jurisprudence, okay, which is an undergraduate degree, because many people in England study law undergraduate. Why do they call it jurisprudence? What is the difference between law and jurisprudence? Well, law is the law. What is the law and how do we apply it? But jurisprudence is the theory of law, the philosophy of the law, the mechanics of not what the law is, but how law, as opposed to the law, how law works. And in that sense, it makes it a much more, you know, foundational study. Do we have a similar thing in halakha? Absolutely. Very often in this year has been entitled for the last 7 years, Baruch Hashem, halachic and hashkafic issues in contemporary society. And we talk a lot about halakha, very specific halachic applications, and we talk a lot about hashkafa, which we've tried to define at times in the past, but I'll try to define it for a second now. Hashkafot are the core Jewish values, as opposed to details, Jewish values which underpin the application of Jewish life, halachic process, etc. Things like Judaism believes in helping the poor and needy, the widow and orphan, believes in the importance of Eretz Yisrael, believes in the importance of Torah learning, believes in the importance of delayed gratification, Olam Haba, metaphysical realities. We could make a list, maybe we should, but not today, of 15, 20 core Jewish hashkafot, which are learned through Midrashim. We'll talk a little bit also when Rav Soloveitchik holds that they learned through halakha. And actually, I don't think that what we call today hashkafos, in terms of Zionist, religious Zionist, modern Orthodox, Haredi, Yeshivish, Hasidish, these are just labels for how we weigh and balance the hashkafot against each other. Meaning, I don't believe that people disagree fundamentally on what that list of 15 to 20 hashkafas are. There's no hashkafa out there today that says, no, Judaism is all about how much you can take and not about how much you can give. Everybody believes the same hashkafic principles. They just balance them and weigh them in different ways. What is the relative importance of learning Torah versus defending Eretz Yisrael? Everyone believes that they are two hashkafic values. The question is, how do you balance them? What is the balance between learning Torah and secular studies? Everyone believes that secular studies is relevant. Chochma bagoyim, amen, says in the Gemara. Believe me, there's chochma out there. The question is, how do you balance that in a legitimate, authentic Jewish life? That's hashkafa. But there's something in the middle of the sandwich. If you imagine halakha is the application, hashkafa is the fundamental matrix. There's something that people sometimes call meta-halacha. Moshe Kapel many years ago wrote an important, small but important book called Meta-Halacha. What is meta-halacha? Meta-halacha is not what the halacha is, but it's a bit like the jurisprudence. It's the way that halacha works. How does halacha operate? Begadol. And then you can apply it in very specific ways. And I think this is a very important topic, and it's not much talked about, because when people express frustration with Judaism, I once heard, I don't remember where I heard it, Christian atheists have a problem with God. Jewish atheists have a problem with rabbis. Okay? They don't have a problem with God. I don't hear many people complaining about God. I hear a lot of people complaining about the rabbis. And what they mean by the rabbis is the halachic process. Why does halacha not change, update? Why is it sexist? Why is it racist? Why is it this? Why is it that? And therefore the study, I don't think those comments are correct, by the way, but the study of the halachic process itself is an important one. Now, we've not spent a lot of time on that, which is fair enough. This, we've had so far something coming up to 270 shirim over the last 7 years, okay. And we haven't talked about much about this, but I want to talk about this for the next 4 sessions. Let me tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to today talk a little bit about subjectivity and objectivity. Okay, it's going to be actually, I think, quite interesting, even though it's more theoretical. I apologize in advance. A lot of the sources on today's sheet are in English because they're written by Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Lichtenstein, and others. Next week, I want to give a specific application. Next week, I'd like to talk about issues over the next few weeks where there is a strong subjectivity in halacha, which is surprising, because usually we say, well, you know, matzah is matzah is matzah is matzah, and a sukkah is a sukkah, and a shofar is a shofar, and it was the same 3,000 years ago as it is today. But sometimes there's a strong subjectivity. For example, next week I want to talk about Beged Ish and Beged Isha. We've never talked about that. This is a very interesting test case in how subjective halachic applications work. The following week, which will be 2 weeks from now, I'd like to talk, going on from there, about a subject which is addressed in my book, which is Dat Yehudit, and also specifically Beged Ish in relation to pants for women, which I think is a fascinating topic as a test case for this as well. And then 3 weeks from now, I want to talk, which is just before Shavuot. It's the Shavuot's on Thursday night, and we have a shir on Wednesday. I don't see why we shouldn't. I want to talk about the issue of smoking. Okay, not just smoking in terms of how the halacha has changed as the, you know, medical advice has changed, but also the fascinating issue of smoking on Yom Tov, which is also a test case not just in smoking itself, but on how halacha reflects the norms of society in different ways. We had a whole shir, if you remember, on showering on Yom Tov. Okay? We never talked about smoking on Yom Tov. These are two things that are separate. Obviously, you can't smoke in the shower on Yom Tov. That will not be a successful venture. Okay, but we will see when we get to smoking. That's what I want to do. And then after Shavuos, we can go on to Pastures New. I really do want to talk about the whole issue of synthetic meat, because it's very much in the news, and there's a whole bunch of kashrus issues we can get to. But that's after Shavuos. My mind is not yet after Shavuos, and I will be away, Be'ezrat Hashem, for a couple of weeks in June. I'll make sure that the OU have all the details, and then we can make sure you know. Okay, fine. Let's first of all set out something which is so basic that no one ever talks about it. What is halacha? What is it? How does it work? So let's start with Rav Lichtenstein. Oh, I forgot to put his name on. I'm sorry. The Human and Social Factor in Halacha is an essay by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I should have put that on. Have a look with me in number one. Hora'ah. Hora'ah is just the Hebrew word for another word for psak. Is comprised of two elements. Psak and psika, respectively. The former, psak, refers to codification, the formulation of the law pertinent to a given area, and is most characteristically manifested in the adoption on textual or logical grounds of one position in preference to another. Meaning, do we pass it like this, or do we pass it like that? What are the sources? As such, it is essentially the concluding phase of the learning process proper, whether on a grand or narrow scale, and its locus is the Bet Midrash, meaning we learn Torah, we learn through the Tanakh and the Gemara, and we learn through the Rishonim, and at the end of that learning process, there's my Havala, as the Gemara says, who do we Paskin like? What is the bottom line? There's a Psak. But there's a learning process first. Okay, that's Psak. Psika, by contrast, denominates implementation. It bespeaks the application of what has already been forged in the crucible of the learning experience to a particular situation. It does not entail the definitive postulation of the law governing a delimited area or its detail. It's not just about what the law is, but rather the concurrent and coordinating meshing of all aspects, possibly drawn from widely divergent spheres, obtaining in a concrete situation. Rav Aaron's English is exceptionally good. If you think that Rav Soloveitchik's English is difficult, it's not. For Rav Soloveitchik, English was his fifth language of something of that nature. He just uses a number of technical, philosophical words like, ontic and neontic, etc. It's not actually hard. Rav Lichtenstein was a master of the English language. He had a PhD. He had a doctorate from Harvard in English. So if you want to read English, read Rav Lichtenstein. But it's, he's basically saying, however, when he gets to Psika, there's a real person standing in front of the Rav. And therefore, the actual implementation of the halacha for that individual must bring in lots and lots of other different factors. Now, what are those factors? That's going to be critical. Are they subjective? Does it depend on the Rav? Does it depend on the Rav's background, etc.? Its venue is publicly the Beit Din, or privately the meeting of the inquirer and the respondent. It does not necessarily demand of the posik that he take a stand or break fresh ground. Its challenge lies in the need to harness knowledge and responsibility at the interface of reality and halacha. Okay, very important opening lines. Psak and psika. Now, we're not going to talk much about psika. When people are trained how to be a rav, how to be a posik, how to be a people-facing, halachic mentor, they need to be taught a lot about psika. How am I relating to this individual? What could I do? Am I trying to be machmir? Am I trying to be mekel? What am I trying to achieve? I'm going to talk more about psak, but we'll talk a little bit at the end about psika. So let's start with psak. When I'm learning in the Beit Midrash, the sources, how objective is that? Does that change with time? So Rav Soloveitchik's opening salvo is, psak is objective. He's very, very insistent on that. Let's take a controversial starting point. Number two. This is a statement in Yevamos, appears in Chazal. Tashma, Da'amar Reish Lakish says, Tav lemeitiv tandu, this is on number two at the bottom of the page, Tav lemeitiv tandu melemeitiv armalu. What does that mean? Tav lemeitiv tandu melemeitiv armalu. The Gemara is there discussing someone who gives a get to a woman through a shaliach, and the woman doesn't know yet about the get. Saying, you be my shliach, this is for my wife, you accept this on behalf of my wife, please. So the question is, we have a principle in halacha, zakin es ha'adam shaloi b'fanav. I can give you a credit without you knowing about it. I can go, if I have your bank details, I can go to your bank and I can say, I'm an anonymous donor and I'd like to pay in, $60,000 to this person's bank account. Please don't tell them who it is. They'll credit it. It's fine as long as they've got the bank details. But if I have your bank details and say, I'm an anonymous person to withdraw $60,000, they shouldn't anyway do that. So say to in halacha, if I'm giving you something which benefits you, you don't need to know about it. We do this all the time, or some of them do this all the time. If you're giving a gift on Shabbat, is halakhically problematic. You can't make a kinyan on Shabbat. One of the ways to deal with that is, if I've been taking, a nice glass dish to someone on Shabbat, I can give it to a third party on Erev Shabbat, say, please lift this up and make a kinyan on it on behalf of Family Cohen. And then can Family Cohen own a glass dish? And I'm not giving it to them on Shabbos. And I go to them on Shabbos and say, here's a beautiful glass dish that you acquired yesterday, but didn't know about it, and therefore no problems. Great. So way to do it. It's fine. But you can't do that if it debits somebody, if it's to their detriment. So is giving a woman a get good for her or bad for her?
Depends.
So the Gemara says, what if the guy is a real rotter? What if the guy, she's waiting to get out of it? What if the guy is just not a good husband? So you could argue, says the Gemara, that you're benefiting her. She's been trying to get out of this marriage, so you're giving this get to a shaliach and it's good for her, so it should work. Says the Gemara, no. Tav lemeitiv tandu, it's better to be living as a couple, milemeitiv aramalu, than to be living alone. There's a chazakah, says the Gemara, that women would prefer to be married, even if the guy's not the best guy, than to be on their own. What does that mean? How does that work? Is that a statement that applies today, just like it did then? Or if you ask the question, we've talked about this a little bit before, of hafka'at kiddushin. Can you implode a marriage because it was a mekach ta'ot? It was a mistaken bargain. Meaning if I go to a shop and order a washing machine and they send it through the delivery and it comes as a dishwasher, I just call them up and say, just pick it up and take it back. This, I don't own this. I didn't pay for this. This is a mekach ta'ot. Take it back. I never bought this. How does that work with a marriage? At what point could a woman turn around and say, I didn't think I was marrying that. He turned into something completely different. Or he was something completely different. The marriage, I don't need a get. Because there was no marriage. The marriage never happened. It was a mekach tos. So obviously in extreme cases, she marries a guy and it turns out that it's his identical twin brother under the chuppah and they only discover later, obviously she's not married. I wanted to marry, you know, Yankel and I ended up marrying, you know, Chaim. But what if she turns around and says, well, I don't know, I had high expectations of this guy, but it didn't work out well. I mean, he's not what he was all cracked up to be. He's not what the Shadchanim told me he would be. Okay, can you turn around and say, well, okay, mekach tos. The Gemara says, and the poskim say, no, you cannot do that. Why? Tav lemeitiv tandum lemeitiv armalu. Of course, maybe she deserves to be given a get, and maybe the marriage should be dissolved, or should be ended, I should say, terminated. But you can't dissolve the marriage, because we assume that a woman would rather be married than vulnerable and single on her own. Now, that sounds like a very controversial statement. Let's go through to page 2. Rav Soloveitchik. In a piece delivered in the 1970s, says as follows, and we'll see Rav Lichtenstein will go back and refer to this later. This has absolutely nothing to do with the social and political status of women in antiquity. Because you might turn around and say, well, of course, in the ancient world, a single woman was incredibly vulnerable, she was prey to be attacked, she needs a husband to look after her, she needs security. Okay, good. You could argue even today it's true in certain societies. She had no independent earning potential. So Rav Soloveitchik, no. The Chazaka is not based on sociological factors, but on a verse in Bereishit. And your desire shall be to your husband. It is not a psychological fact. It is an existential fact. To say that Tav Lemeitiv Tandum Lemeitiv Armalu was due to the inferior political or social status of women at that time is simply misunderstanding the Chazakah. Not only the Halachot, but also the Chazakot of our sages of blessed memory introduced are indestructible. You must not tamper not only with the Halachot, but even with the Chazakot, the assumptions. For the Chazakot spoke not upon transient psychological behavioral patterns, but on permanent ontological principles. This is the nature of existence, rooted in the very depths of the metaphysical human personality, which is as changeless as the heavens above. Strong statement. Yeah. You can't turn around with a chazaka and say, well, it doesn't work that way anymore in 21st century life. Women would prefer to be single now. No, these chazakot are indestructible. They are the axioms of Torah, and they're objective, they're not subjective. And the Rav talks a lot in Halachic Mind. The Rav wrote a lot of works, but two famous ones are Isha Halacha, which is Halachic Man, which was translated into English, and Halachic Mind, which he actually wrote earlier than Isha Halacha, and he wrote also in English. Halachic Mind, at least in my experience, is a much tougher read than Halachic Man. Halachic Mind, I've given a few good stabs at it over the years. I get a little bit further each time, but it's not an easy read. But one of the things he says there, he talks about objectification, and I've referred you in the footnotes to something which I strongly recommend. If you want to understand as on an introductory level, but quite comprehensive, Rav Soloveitchik's thought, then Rav Reuven Ziegler wrote a book called Majesty and Humility about 10 years ago. I think it's probably available here. I believe it was OU Press that published the book. It's a fantastic book. It really is a great introduction. It's a very detailed book. It's about 300-400 pages into Rav Soloveitchik's thought. And he talks about objective and subjective ideas. Look at what Rav Soloveitchik says, number 4. Objectification reaches its highest expression in the halakha. Halakha is the act of seizing the subjective flow and converting it into enduring and tangible magnitudes. It is the crystallization of the fleeting individual experience into fixed principles and universal norms. Now, he's going to give you quite a hard sentence, but it's a good one. In short, halakha is the objectifying instrument of our religious consciousness, the form principle of the transcendental act, the matrix in which the amorphous religious halo is cast. Or cast, sorry, my northern roots just came out for a second there. What's he talking about here? He's saying the following. Life is very ephemeral, you know? Things come and go. We're only here for a limited amount of time, 120 years. And lots of things feel as though they're very much my perception. I can't even prove, certainly according to Descartes, that any of you even exist. The Koshi, it's hard enough to maybe even convince myself that I exist. At least if I only think I exist, there must be an I who's thinking that I exist, so I must exist somewhere down there, but I have no guarantees that any of you are anything other than just subjective impressions being made on my mind. Who knows if I'm just a brain in a box being, you know, manipulated by some evil scientist, etc., etc. Says Rav Soloveitchik, halacha is your answer. It objectifies the religious consciousness. Religious consciousness is very individual. Yours is different from mine, is different from hers. But halacha objectifies it. It's the form principle. I had to look at what form principle means. Form principle, at least I think, is what he's talking about, is a term in art, where you look at all these very subjective things as to how you see the structure and how you see the lighting and how you see the texture and how you see the context, and you form you make a form principle which enables you to actually create something objective on a page that someone can look at and see what you're talking about. And of course the matrix in which the aformous religious halo is cast, the halo means something which has not yet been turned into its concrete form. The Ramban talks a lot about this at the beginning of Breishit, the different theories on how the world was created. So one he brings is that originally there was God and a halo. A halo is the Greek word for sort of chaos or amorphous, non-created matter. And God fixed it into the universe and created it, which is Plato's perspective on that. But Rav Soloveitchik is into objectifying. And he says that's you first create objective halacha, and from there you can create philosophy. From there you can create hashkafic values. From there you can create religious experiences. Rav Soloveitchik is not that interested in how you feel. Oh, I feel as a religious experience this. He's more interested in how the halacha makes you feel. Once you've internalized the halacha, that feeling is a more real feeling. Before the halacha, the feeling could be just, well, maybe your feelings are unreliable. Maybe you're just, maybe your blood sugar is a bit imbalanced today. That's why you feel that way. It's not real, in a sense. So I brought you a couple of concrete examples, which have nothing to do with the shir specifically, but we've talked about them before, and I want to talk about them again, just so you don't feel you're getting too much English in the shir. Where do we get halachic and hashkafic values from? Rav Soloveitchik says, from halacha, from the details itself. Now you might argue, well, don't we get them from Midrash? Don't we get them from the narrative? That's also a possibility. We've talked about that. Rav Soloveitchik is less interested in that and more interested in the halachic side. Have a look here in number 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. 5 and 6 are from last week's Parsha. Oh, sorry, 6, 7 and 8 are, but 5 and 6 let's do before. V'asita ayashav atov. Mitzvah, one of the 613. Do the right thing. Do the good thing. Be'enei Hashem, in God's eyes. How do I know what that is? Do the right thing. So says the Ramban, number 6. L'rabbiseinu bazeh midrash yafeh. The rabbis have a very beautiful explanation. Amru, they say this is pshara, the art of compromise in a din. Unlifnim mishuras adin, or going beyond the letter of the law. Compromise in a monetary din, where he claims 1,000, she says she doesn't have to pay anything. They settle in the middle somewhere. So what does that mean? Hakavana bazeh, what does this mean? Ki mitzchila ama shetishmor chukosav eidosav asher tzivcha. Originally, the Torah sets out lots of very specific laws. The ata, and then he says, Yomei, he says, gam ba'asher lo tzivcha, even in what has not been commanded, ten datcha, you have to use your understanding, la'asot atov ha'yasha be'enav, to do the right thing. Ki hu ahev atov ha'yasha, because God wants you to do the right thing. Vezeh inyan gadol, this is massive, he says. The Torah can never tell you every detail of how to live your life. Im shcheinav, how to treat your neighbors, reyav, your friends, kol maso matna, your business life, v'tikunei hayishuv, social, communal life, medinos kulams, political life. The Torah, you can't look everything up in the Mishnah Brura. Aval achrei shehizki mehem harbeh, but the Torah gives you lots of specific mitzvot. Kagon, he's dealing with Ben Adam Lechavero here. Lo selich rachel, don't go spreading rumors about people. Lo sikim v'lo sitoi, don't take revenge or bear a grudge. Lo samad adam reecha, don't stand by while others are suffering. Lo tekalel cheresh, don't curse even a deaf person who can't hear you. Mipnei seva takom, get up in front of the elderly, in front of the wise. Once you've learned all those mitzvahs, ukiyotze behem, and similar, chazar loma, then the Torah can say to you, b'derech klal, in a roundabout way, in a general way, sheyase atov ha'yashab chol davar. Meaning, the Ramban saying, every time we learn a specific mitzvah, a specific halacha, stand up in front of the elderly, or don't stand by while people need your help, we're not just meant to be learning the details of that halacha, but we're meant to be deriving from it a halachic value. That's how we build our halachic values. And then when there's a situation which is not, you know, legislated specifically, I can't just look it up in a textbook, I'll know what to do. I'll know how to do the right thing. Because I've internalized halacha, objective halacha, and realized what kind of a person the Torah wants me to be. Very important idea. Also, too, in Bein Adam LaMakom, number 7, this is more famous. Dabera kol adab b'nei Yisrael ve'amart aleim kedoshim tiyu. Be kadosh. What does it mean to be kadosh? So I'm not going to read the Ramban, but he says the same thing. He says that a person has to work out how to be kadosh. They can't just follow the letter of the law. Because you could drink mahadrin wine, but be a drunkard and, you know, and get drunk and lie on the floor every night. You could eat mahadrin meat and be a glutton. Says what the Torah wants you to do is after it gives you all the specific mitzvahs, this is kosher, this is not kosher, this is Shabbos, this is not allowed on Shabbos, etc., etc., etc. Now you work out based on these halachic details what the halachic values of life are, and that's how you'll be a kaddish person. It's very interesting. So in that sense, what the Rav is saying is that there is a really important objectivity to halacha, and from that halacha we derive more subjective values. But first comes the objective. Then comes how I derive subjective from it. Halacha is objective. Look at number 9 and 10, briefly. Says Rav Soloveitchik also in Halachic Mind, there is only a single source which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung could emerge. The objective order, the halacha. In this, he's going to be unhappy with Maimonides. Maimonides learns Jewish philosophical principles, not just or specifically from the halacha, but from other sources. He says very clearly in the introduction to Shmona Prakim, which is his commentary on his introduction to Perkei Avos, I learn MS from whoever says MS. And if the MS comes from Aristotle, then good on Aristotle. I will use that as a Jewish philosophical view. And if the MS comes from Al-Farabi or Ibn Sina, then I will use that as well. And the Rambam also says that. It's fascinating. He says, and if people are going to get upset when you quote Aristotle, or Ibn Sina, or Al-Farabi, or whatever it is. So just don't say it in their name. Just say, a great sage said, because why should you care? Like, why get people upset? You don't have to say everything's from Aristotle. But if it's true, it's true. The Rav doesn't like that at all. The Rav says, you can't get Jewish philosophy from Aristotle. You get Jewish philosophy from the details of the halacha. And finally, number 10 on this point, there is no direct approach to pure religious subjectivity. Objective forms must be postulated as a point of departure, and by moving in the minus direction, one may gradually reconstruct underlying subjective aspects. Objectivity explored in retrospect yields subjectivity. Other methods are fruitless. Fine. And actually, this is rooted in a mystical idea. Look in the Zohar, number 11, and of course, don't forget the Soloveitchiks were briskers, and the briskers are Kabbalists. Not maybe the same kind of Kabbalists as Rav Abu Chatzera, but they were rooted in the Gaon, and the Gaon was a Mekubal. Number 11, the Zohar. Kud shebrichu istakel be'oraita ubara alma. God looked into the Torah, whatever Torah means there. Obviously not Vayidabe Hashem al Moshe le'mor Torah, but there's a pre-existent reality of Torah, maybe the Torah is God's mind, and created the world from the Torah. Barnash, and now a person, mistakel bo, ba'oraita, can look in the Torah, umakayim alma, and through that uphold the world. But the Torah precedes the world, not the world precedes the Torah. That's a very clear view in objectivity. You can even give this, you know, I once heard Rabbi Tatz say, when it says God has a hand, a yad. So what does that mean? So the Rambam will say, it doesn't mean God has a hand. A hand is just a metaphor for strength and intervention, etc. The Kabbalists will say, no, God has a hand. Not a hand like you and me. The real hand is the yad in the metaphysical world. Our physical hand is simply a reflection of an objective metaphysical reality, which is the real reality, and we think this is a hand, but this is not a hand. This is the reflection of the true hand, which is the metaphysical hand. So Rav Soloveitchik is coming from there as well. Anyway, ad kan, the complicated quotes from Halachic Mind. But what's going on here? It's objective. However, objectivity doesn't mean that the Rav can't make chidush. Rav Soloveitchik was a big chadshan. He was into chidush. Let's look at the ideas of chidush in reaching psak. Meaning, objectivity just doesn't mean I just say what I heard from my rabbis, or does it? Let's have a look. Look at number 12. Chamisha Talmidim Hayil Rabbanan Yochanan ben Zakkai. Perkei Avos. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai had five main Talmidim. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, Rabbi Shu ben Chananya, Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Hu Hayamonish Beshpachan. He used to praise them. He he used to say, look at what he said about them. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, Bor Sid is a lined cistern. She'enu ma'abed tipa, and not a single drop ever leaks out of it. Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach, but Rabbi Eliezer Arach is a ma'ayan mitgaber, is an ever increasing flowing spring. Both metaphors of water, because water and Torah go together, but one is a borsid, is a cistern which never leaks a drop, but doesn't create its own water, just never loses what it received, and the other is a constantly renewing, you know, spring, which is always producing new water. Which is the best? So look what the Pirkei Avos says. Hu haya omer, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the master would say, if all of the sages of Israel were on one side of the scales, the Eliezer ben Hurkanus, the one who never let a drop go, was on the Bekaf Shnia, was on the other side, Makriya et Kulam. He would outweigh everybody. So what is more important, Chiddush or tradition? Tradition. Tradition. I'm not going to sing the song right now. Okay. But then it says, Abba Shaul Omer. But Abba Shaul says, no. You got it wrong. That's not what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say. He says in the name Mishmo of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, no, im you kol chachmi Israel, if all the Jewish sages, bekaf mozaim, are in one side of the scale, the Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, af imahem, even with Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, the great cistern with them, but Rabbi Eliezer, bekaf shnia, but Rabbi Eliezer was on the other side, machriye kolam, he'd outweigh all of them. So we have two different traditions. What is the main purpose here? Is it preserving or is it producing? Is it innovation? In the process of Psak, two different approaches. If you look at number 13 and 14. 13, Tan Rabbana. Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Eliezer sheshavas b'Galil. Rabbi Eliezer spent Shabbos in Galil one day. Galil Ha'elyon, in the upper Galilee. V'shalu shloishim halachas b'hilchas sukkah. They asked him, 30 halachas in sukkah, hilchas sukkah. Maybe it was Shabbos Cholamei Sukkos, maybe it was Yom Tov, not sure. 12, he said, I heard the answer, this is the answer. Shmona asa amalehem, lo shamati. But 18 of them said, I don't know, I never heard. So they said to him, Amrullah, they said to him, kol devarecha eincha el mipi hashmua. Well, you don't have an opinion of your own? You're not prepared to say anything unless you heard it? You're just transmitting? So he got upset with them. Amalehem, his kaktuni lomar dava shelo shamati mipi rabotai. Are you trying to get me to say something I never heard from my rabbis? Lo amarti dava shelo shamati mipi rabbi me'olam. I never, ever said anything unless it was Torah that I received from my rav. The cistern that never loses a drop. Compared with, look at Rabbi Yeshua, number 14. Tan Rabbana, ma'asi b'Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, v'Rabbi Elazar b'Chasma, shehalchu lehagbil p'nei Rabbi Yeshua b'Piki'in. They went to Piki'in, also in the north. This is where they all lived, in the Galilee. They went to receive Rabbi Yeshua. Amar lahem, and he said to them, "Ma chidush hayu bebeis hamedrash hayom?" Oh, what was a chidush? What was the new thing you heard today that you never ever heard before? So they say to him, Amrullah, they say to him, Rabbi, you want a chidush from us? Talmidech anu, we are your talmidim. Umeimech anu shotim, we drink from your water. Same idea. And he smiles and he says to them, Amar lahem, afal pikein. Yeah, okay, that's fine. But nevertheless, e efshele beis medrash beloy chiddush. There has to be chiddush. There has to be something new. And in fact, famously, Rabbi Eliezer, who only retained, was a student of Beis Shammai. He was a shamuti. He was an objectivity in its extreme. Where Rabbi Yeshua was from Bet Hillel. Where did Bet Hillel come from? Bavel. What did he introduce? The 7 of the 13 hermeneutical principles, or at least he championed them, he's into interpretation and exegesis, bringing out new ideas. Where Rabbi Eliezer is Beis Shammai, he is into tradition and preserving. Two very different schools of thought. It's not a coincidence. Remember the story, I brought it on the top of the page on page 4, but we learned it recently, so I'm not going to read it now. The famous story of the Tanur Shel Achnoi, where they're arguing, is the oven Tameh, is the oven Tahor? And Rabbi Eliezer's, the same Rabbi Eliezer is bringing all the proofs. The carob tree will prove it, and the river will prove it, and the walls of the Beis HaMikdash. Eventually he brings out a voice from heaven. God Almighty will tell me that I'm right. And a bas kol comes out and says, he's right. And Rabbi Yeshua stands up and says, Lo b'shamayim. I am not restricted to what heaven says. I am a human being, I'm a Rav, and I have a responsibility to be Mechadesh. We learned a beautiful Medrash a while ago from Tana de Eliyahu, a marshal that the king that gives his two servants a bag of wheat and a bundle of flax. Do you remember this? And he says to him, I'm coming back in a week. I'll see what you've got. So one servant took the wheat and took the flax and put it in the cupboard safe so the king will have it when he comes back. And the other servant took the flax and beat it into linen and made a beautiful tablecloth and took the wheat and made it into pastries. And then when the king came back, he said, okay, let me see what you've got. So one Nebuch servant brought out a bag of wheat and a bundle of flax. Here you are, your majesty. And the other said, your majesty, Kabbalat Panim, here's a beautiful table set with a linen tablecloth. And he said, what a disgrace for the first one. He thought he was just meant to keep the wheat. He was meant to process it, turn it into something new. He can't bring in his own wheat, but he has to turn it into something new. And this is a very, very beautiful idea. The Netziv, I want to mention here in his Hakdamah, to the Perush on the Sheil Tot, he has a Hakdamah called the Kidmat HaEmek. And the Netziv, of course, the Rosh Hashiva of Elazhen, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he has a beautiful thesis. I'll just mention it now because you can go away and think about it. It's very exciting. If you remember in Vezot HaBracha, it says that the Torah was given Eish Dat Lamo. Eish Dat. It's pronounced as two words, it was written as one word. Eish Dat. So says the Netziv, Torah is Eish or Torah is Dat. Which? So he says, if you go through history, there are periods of history where we consolidated, brought things together, made them into something which is preserved, okay, conserved. That's Dat. That's tradition. And there are other periods of Jewish history where we took what we'd received from the previous generation and burnt it down and created something new. That's Eish. And he says, we have this going up and down, you have a pattern throughout history. The Mishnah was Dat, consolidating. The Gemara was Eish, expanding. The Gaonim was Dat, consolidating. The Rishonim was Eish, expanding. The Shulchan Aruch was Dat, consolidating. And he goes through this, it's very, very, very beautiful, this idea that both of those things come together. So even though Halacha is objective, there's no question that there has to be chidush as well. However, there is a limit, and this is important. I want to bring you a piece from Rav Shechter here. Look at number 18. Rabbi Eliezer Hamodai Omer, Hamagali Panim B'Torah, someone who reveals new things, new faces to the Torah, Shalok Halacha, which are not halachic, Afal Pishiyesh B'Yadah Torah U'Masim Tov, even though he has a lot of Torah and a lot of mitzvahs, Eino Chelik L'Olam Haba. You can't make up your own Torah. So what's the difference between chidush, which is allowed in the objective halachic process, and shinui, where you've reformed halacha? Look at Rav Shechter. It's a beautiful piece, a short piece. Judaism number 19. Judaism allows for chiddush, innovation, but not shinui, change. Despite this emphasis on tradition, Judaism is not frozen in place. Halachic man. Rav Soloveitchik was traditional, objective halacha, but a big chachan, lots of chiddush. Minor practices such as the design or color of a synagogue's parochas can change easily. Rules that are more rigid must also respond appropriately to changed circumstances. Someone committed to the Masorah must inquire of his Rebbe Mufak to learn when and how to change practices while remaining within traditional attitudes and patterns of behavior. Just as science progresses, so too halacha advances. The Midrash states, there is no day in which God doesn't innovate a halacha in the heavenly court. Similarly, Yalkut Shimoni says, Yivcha Elohim Chadashim, they chose new gods, as Yivcha Elohim Chadashim, that God chooses new things. God likes new things. God appreciates Torah innovations. The Rav would often say, Rav Soloveitchik, that Judaism allows for chidush, innovation, but not shinui, change. Not every chidush, however, is acceptable. Tosafos notes a contradiction between two Talmudic passages. The Gemara in Pesachim states that one should learn Torah even without the proper motivation, because from doing so he'll eventually arrive at the proper motivation. In contrast, the Gemara in Bracha states that he who studies Torah with the wrong motivation would have been better off never having been born. The Netziv resolves this contradiction by explaining that learning extant Torah, meaning existing Torah, without issuing any new rulings or innovative interpretations, is permissible, even a mitzvah, regardless of motivation. It doesn't matter how motivated I am in the right way or the wrong way, if I just, you know, pass you a shalom from Shulchan Aruch. How do I make a cup of tea on Shabbos? You do this, this, and this. Shkoyach. Anyone can look that up. No one cares what my motivation is. You know, better I do it, and I'll get to a better motivation. After all, he's learning Torah.
However, chidushei Torah, creating new interpretations, requires the proper motivation, and if done with the wrong intentions, is spiritually poisonous because the practitioner biases his judgment towards his personal desires. How do I know as a posek when my excitement for chidush in the psak process has stepped over a line and now I'm just making stuff up? Maybe I watched too many movies. Maybe I read too many novels. Maybe that affected my mind. And now I'm seeing halacha. Maybe I am too liberal or too conservative or too something which is not Torah. And that's affecting my psak. Says that's something that you have to be careful about. And, you know, he goes on and explains other ideas. And I brought you on page 5. There's an entire book written by Rabbi Michael Broyd. Rabbi Michael Broyd writes books which are worth reading. And he wrote a book called Innovation in Jewish Law, a case study of Chiddush in Havineinu. We're Havineinu meaning the brocha, the little brocha that you say when you don't have time to say the whole Shemona Esrei. He wrote a whole book using that as a test case for Chiddush. I'm not going to read this now. Read it on your own, please. 20 and 21. This is an explanation of what is Chiddush and what is Shinui, which is not acceptable. I would just make one last point on this, which is one other question which defines how much leeway a Rav has in coming to a psak is, who can a Rav disagree with? Who can you go back and say, well, yeah, that was the halacha, but I don't agree. I want to do something different. So that is a principle called Itmar Hilchata or Halacha Kebatraya. Again, these are meta-halachic principles. And we can only touch on the surface here, but I think it's important. For example, there is a fundamental assumption, an axiom of Jewish law, that says something called Chatimat Hashas, Chasimas Hashas, that the Gemara has been sealed. You cannot argue with the Gemara. You can work out what the Gemara says. You can try and interpret the Gemara to reach this is the conclusion of the Gemara, but you can't argue with the Gemara. That's an axiom. That's really one of the fundamental, or used to be, differences between Orthodox and conservative halachic analysis. Meaning the Reform movement doesn't accept halacha as a valid way of coming to truth. So that makes it actually easier to deal with the Reform movement because they don't have any real interest in halacha as a practical way to resolve questions. But the conservative movement broke away from the Reform movement and said, no, we actually do think halacha is important, therefore we're going to produce tshuvas. And there are early days in conservative movement, still today, tshuvot, response to produce. But one of the most important differences between those and an Orthodox tshuva is, no Orthodox posek can argue on the Gemara, but the conservative movement doesn't accept that. And very often you'll see a conservative tshuva where he says, we analyze the Gemara and the answer is this. But it's 2023 and we had a vote and there are 15 of us on the committee and 9 to 6 we voted to go against that and to do something different. That can never happen in the classic halachic system. Now again, you can be innovative interpretation. I'll give you an example. Rav Moshe Feinstein is dealing with the status of milk in modern-day Western societies. Is it kosher or is it not? So prima facie, it's not kosher. Why? Because the Gemara says all milk produced by non-Jews is not kosher unless it's supervised, unless the milking system is supervised by a Jew. It's black and white. It's very simple. They didn't give exceptions. So the milk should be not kosher. You can't argue with the Gemara. Rav Moshe can't come along and say, yeah, that was in those days. Now I don't think milk needs to be supervised by a Jew. The Chazal's principle is now superseded. But what he does say is, if you read the sugyas carefully, you'll see that the milk that Chazal were talking about was milk that could have been adulterated with non-kosher milk. And that's when they said it has to be supervised. But of course, if you have milk that could never have been adulterated, that's not what they were talking about. And that's what our milk is. Our milk today could not possibly be mixed with pig milk or camel's milk because there's such supervision by the FDA or whoever it is, and that it could never happen. So I'm not arguing with Chazal. I'm just telling you Chazal weren't talking about this case. They were talking about that case. Okay, so you can argue that, well, that is effectively arguing, but it's through a system of interpretation rather than frontal arguing. So have a look in number 22. Have a look in the Ramah. The Ramah says, Mihu yesh omrim de'im nira l'dayan. If any particular dayan, posek, says or thinks, l'bnei doiro, for his own generation, if he comes to a conclusion, mikayach rayas muchrochas, and he has good proofs, she'ein hadin kamosha huska b'poskim, that the din is different from what came previously, yochel lachlok alav. Any Rav can argue on any other Rav, as long as it's not in the Gemara. As long as it's not arguing with the Gemara. in theory, I don't care who came before. If I've got broad enough shoulders, and I'm not using the word I here for me, because I don't have anything like that, but a Pesach, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Vilna Gaon, is halakhically allowed, according to the Ramah, to argue with anybody going back all the way to the Gemara. The only impermeable membrane is the Gemara. You can't argue with the Gemara. Interpret, Paskin, but you can't argue with it. But you can argue with anybody else. So it says the Ramah, that's the halacha. That gives a Rav, if he's got broad enough shoulders and strong enough proofs, the ability to argue on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Rishonim, in theory. Now, they don't tend to. They tend to not do that. But in theory, according to this, they could. Whereas others say no. If you look over the page at the Chazon Ish, look at 24 for a second. The Chazon Ish says, no, I think there are other lines that we draw in the sand. Sof dava, hahora hamakubelet mipi rabbeinu. When we receive a psak from our rabbis, asher mipi emanu chaim, and we live through their psak, kamar, and he gives a list. Moran, Bet Yosef, the Bet Yosef, Amagen Avram, Hamishna Brura, he hora makuyemet. That is established psak. It's what we call itma hilchasa. It's been laid down. Kamar mipi Sanhedrin belishka dagazit. It's as if the Sanhedrin said it. And this actually is a very important point, because even though a Rav is allowed to be Mechadesh, some poskim take the view that there are lines in the sand that you just can't cross. Have you ever had an experience where, you know, someone says, I'm sorry, this is what the halacha is in the Mishnah Berurah says this, there's nothing we can do. That's the halacha. Whereas another posik will say, okay, the Mishnah Berurah says this, but why do we have to agree with the Mishnah Berurah? Why can't we argue with the Mishnah Berurah? As long as we're not arguing with the Gemara. I remember I had an experience. I had many experiences. I used to daven in a Yekesh Ashur in London, Monks, which is like the last bastion. You know, you look at the Chumash of the guy next to you, and it says Im Angfan Schaf Gott der Himmel und der Himmel als der Erde. You know, it's all in German there still. You know, right, exactly, right. It's like Washington Heights, whatever. So I once, you know, they were starting Mincha, and he once was like 5 minutes after Shkia. So I turned round to one of the guys there. One of the guys said, "How can we start Mincha? It's 5 minutes after Shkia." So he goes, "So what? It's 5 minutes after Shkia." So I said, "Yeah, this says in the Mishnah Berurah that." Oh my goodness, that was the last thing I should have said. He said, "Why do we have to follow the psak of the Mishnah Berurah?" He talked like that as well. I'm not just using it for effect. Why are we bound? We're not bound by that. We have our own Masoras. We argue. So certain poskim will take a more conservative view in who I can argue with, and some poskim will take a broader view, as long as it's not the Gemara or usually the Rishonim. Some poskim will be more chiddush oriented, and some will be less. Yes.
Or the Mishnah Berurah.
Yes. Of course, they pass another Chayadim or whoever.
Okay, no, they were Chayadim. They were Aruch HaShulchan. I mean, they were poskim.
Yes, of course they were.
And one could then say, well, they pass in a slightly different fashion.
100%. We could give a whole series on this. Go away and read Rupture and Reconstruction by Professor Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Was a landmark essay he wrote in 25 years ago. What does that make it? 97, something like that. 95. All about how the nature of Masorah changed through the 19th and 20th centuries from what it had been, and we ended up, you know, latching on to more of a codified halachics. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the other things. Now, just for the last 10 minutes of the shiur, I don't want to keep you late. So what have we talked about? Let's get clarity in our mind. Halacha is two things, psak and psika. Psak is objective. But the process of reaching a psak requires you to look at the sources and then apply a chiddush. The chiddush, of course, the chiddush is going to be somewhat subjective. Somewhat. The process of chiddush, the way that the Briska Rav and Rav Soloveitchik analyze something, is different from the way that Rav Avadi Yosef analyzes something. But still, that's part of the objective process of psak. What about when I get to the last stage of psika? And this is some beautiful, I want to just share with you in the last 10 minutes, some beautiful, beautiful lines from Rav Lichtenstein. I'll just refer you, just before I do this, I'm not going to read this, but on page 8, I brought you a whole page from Rav Soloveitchik in Nuvikashta Misham on the difference, according to him, between Chiddush and Shinui. You can read that in your own time. We don't have time for it now. But he has a beautiful, he compares it with Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics. He compares it with maths. It has beautiful applications there. Read that if you like in your own time. But I want to just deal now with Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein, I did not know him personally. I met him, but I didn't know him personally. But in addition to being a planet brain in both Kodesh and Chol, he was an incredibly sensitive individual. Incredibly sensitive. And one of the things he was trying to put up, I didn't learn in the Gush, my son learned in the Gush. He was in the very end of Rav Lichtenstein's being the Rosh Hashiva, so he didn't really get to know him either. But the sensitivity is very much part of the way that he tries to give over his methodology in Pesach. So look here in a couple of these sources. I'm just going to do 25, 27, 8, and 9, and then we'll finish. Look at 25. So now he's talking about Psika. Meaning, I've got my Psach. I've worked it out. I've gone through my Chiddush. I've reached an objective Psach through the process of analysis. But now I have a person in front of me. How do I apply that? So he says the following. Number 25. The cogency and legitimacy of a human approach, according to approach to Psach, appears to many problematic. Should your Rav be a human being, or should he be a computer? What's the new thing they've got now called ChatGPT, sorry, I'm showing myself a little bit out of the loop here. Rav Rimon in Alon Shvut on Purim, he read out, as his drosha, he asked a number of shilas to ChatGPT or whatever it's called, and he gave us the answers that the computer gave. And it was actually really interesting and very, very funny, okay? I wish we could have taped it. But anyway, so he says, should your Rav be a human? The cogency and legitimacy of a human approach to Psach appears to many problematic. They would have us believe that the ideal Posek is a faceless and heartless supercomputer into whom all of the relevant data is fed and who then produces the right answer. Should this standard not be met, the shortfall is regarded as a failing, the lamentable result of human frailty. On this reading, the process of Psika, properly conceived and executed, bears no semblance to an existential encounter between seeker and respondent. It entails rather the application of text to problem, the coupling of code and situation. This conception does not necessarily preclude reckoning with the specific circumstances of the question and questioner, as these may well be part of the relevant objective data. Of course, every POSIC has to look at the specific circumstances, because that's part of the PSAC. That's not the PSICA. I can't just give one PSAC for everything. The prevailing tendency, however, will be to dwarf this factor. And as to the human aspect of the Meshiv, that will be obviated entirely. He, for his part, is to be animated by the precept that we do not have mercy in judgment, and hence to pass on the merits of the issue with imperviously stony objectivity. Purist proponents of this approach often cry it up as the Frum view of Psika. The word Frum has an interesting history, by the way. It was originally used in a negative sense of someone who has false piety, or religiosity. But anyway, that's a different discussion. In reality, however, this portrait of a posek is a mere caricature, limbed by those who at most karu v'shanu, meaning they think they've learned this and they've learned that, but lo shimshu. But they didn't really sit with a real posek. As anyone who has been privileged to observe gedolim at close hand can readily attest, they approach psak doubly animated by responsibility to halacha and sensitivity to human concerns. The balance between norms and need may be variously struck. There certainly are ideological differences amongst poskim on how much weight to assign the human factor. In principle, however, recognition of this factor is the rule rather than the exception. Says Rav Lichtenstein, that when you're dealing with a real person, your process of psika has to be dealing with this person as an individual in a very subjective way as much as you possibly can. Of course, your psak is objective. You learned that through analysis. But your application has to be as subjective as is legitimate. Go over the page. 27. It is this concept which undergirds the legitimacy of recourse to minority opinions. How can you just reach for an opinion and say, well, you really need a heter, let's rely on this. Inasmuch as these opinions are not simply dismissed as erroneous, but procedurally rejected, they are very much alive, held in reserve where they can be culled from the shelf in a crisis. In effect, the principle of Rabbi so-and-so is worthy of being relied on in exigent circumstances states that, while a given view has been accepted la halacha as part of our third tier, in an emergency, we envision ourselves back at the middle tier. I didn't get into the middle tier and the third tier, that's in the previous source. Sans decisive resolution, and hence as authorized to heed another view. Moreover, and this is no less remarkable, under the pressure of circumstance, we are not bound by the general directive of Sofik Daraisa Lachumra, but are entitled to follow a lenient minority. This license raises obvious questions. How liberally and by whom can it be exercised? From how far back can discarded shitot be extracted? From the Mishnah? From the Gemara? Rishonim? Early Achronim? Which views, if any, might indeed be treated as error? On what basis? At the practical plane, these issues need to be clarified, but that task lies beyond my present scope. Here I content myself with an account of the principle and its rationale as a manifestation of concern for the human and social element within psyche. Let me give you an example of this. I once went to a Rav in London with a shaila about mikveh. And my wife had an operation on her finger, and she had stitches in her finger, which needed to be removed. They were not permanent, and they were not going to just dissolve themselves. And they were a chatzitza then. And I went to the Rav that we always go to, and I said, look, you know, Rabbi, it's important for various different reasons that we try to get to the mikveh, but like, what about my, you know, the situation? So he said, look, in everything that I've learned, in all the poskim I've met, and in all the material I've studied, I can't find any way to say that this is mutter. But you know what? Call up Dan Lopian and see what he has to say. That was always a great and interesting option. Dan Gershon Lopian, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, had masoras from Lithuania. They were masoras. You know, when you asked him how much matzah you eat on Pesach or Mar or whatever, he didn't give you a plastic laminated sheet. He went like, you know, about this much. I had like a handful. You know, he had masoras as to how things worked. And I called him up and I went round and he asked me all sorts of weird, interesting questions. Put your hand to the light. Does it look like this? Does it look like that? Etc. He said, it's mutter. It's mutter. So I went back to my rabbi and I said, he said it's mutter. He goes, wow. No idea what he's talking about. But, you know, he was applying that. He reached for a shita that he said was a relevant one, and he applied it. It is sometimes thought that the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, was opposed to this approach. Oh, the Rav is objective, supercomputer. No, he said wrong. To the best of my knowledge, this assumption is primarily based on a page drawn from Ma'adodech Midod, in which he emphatically rejects the notion that psychosocial elements are factored into the halachic process and affect its course. Yes, that's what the Rav disagrees with. Several sentences in this vein are admittedly sharp, sweeping. Remember what we said? Tov lemeitiv tandu is not based on women's position in society. It's an objective chazaka. And yet, careful examination of this tenuously balanced passage reveals that its primary thrust is not denial of a human consideration, but insistence on the autonomy of halacha. And then the final source, let me give you this to go away and think about. These are imminent questions. 28. We'll finish with this. And to be honestly and conscientiously confronted. Honesty was Rav Lichtenstein's touchstone. An honest person. Surely we have no right to demand of a posek, almost as a matter of moral and personal right, the most comforting answer. Yeah? You can't shop around in the sense that I just want the posek to tell me it's okay, because that's what I want to do. The notion that, and he brings up Blue Greenberg's quote, which later she said, I didn't mean it this way, whatever, I've never spoken to her about it, I'd be fascinated to. Blue Greenberg fascinatingly famously said, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way. Meaning, you know something, if the rabbis wanted to, they can give you a hetzer, they just don't want to. They have a cookie jar with a very tightly screwed on lid, and if you ask for a cookie, they won't give one. And if you nudge and nudge and nudge and nudge and nudge, maybe they'll screw the lid and say, okay, here's your one, but you can't have any more. Just keep nudging and you'll get... They just need... He says, that's not true. Both insults Gedolei Torah, collectively, and is in its insuicent view of the totality of halacha, verges on the blasphemous. That's quite a strong language for Aaron Lichtenstein. What we do expect of a posek is that he will walk the extra mile. Whatever for him it may be, harnessing knowledge and imagination in an attempt to abide by his responsibility to both the Torah with which he has been entrusted and to his anguished fellow whose pangs he has internalized. For insensitive psyche is not only lamentable apathy, but poor public policy, it is bad halakha. To the extent that covered habrius, for example, permits a violation, be it of a drabonon or a deraisa passively, failure to act on that principle undercuts the spiritual ideal. The Rav was fond of quoting the Chofetz Chaim to the effect that interruption of Kriyashma when enabled the Bnei HaKavod was not permissible but mandatory. Think of what he just said there. He said, or mandatory. I don't even know which way to pronounce mandatory. Mandatory. Okay, fine. He's saying that when the halacha says that if somebody asks you a question in the middle of the Shema, you're allowed to interrupt to respond, it doesn't mean you're allowed. It means you're obligated. Because how can you insult the person? When Chazal said you can, they mean that you must, said the Chofetz Chaim. Human dignity, covered Habrius. And I brought other ideas in the footnote. What about Darchi Noam, Darchi Shalom, Eis La'asos La'Shem? There's lots of broader principles. As the Rav would have preferred the term human sanctity, is hardly a neutral matter. Poskim, especially in the modern era, are often reluctant to invoke broad axiological heterium when they can construct more narrowly based decisions in which local and possibly technical factors are more prominent. Psika ka kongilin tsepsak, and a decision issued with trepidation in the light of specific circumstances can then enter the halachic world as a precedent. The danger is particularly acute at a time when many, within and without the pale of commitment, seek to prance on every such tack in order to promote an ideological agenda. What he's saying is that, yeah, people have to be careful because sometimes a very subjective tack to an individual who really needs it gets out there in the world, and then everyone's screaming and shouting, we can rely on that. Or this rabbi's an apikoros. I've asked shilas, by the way, to people who haven't been given a tack, and I've been told, don't tell anybody else that I said this. And if you do, then I'll deny it. You know, because it's for you. It's not for anybody else. There is a danger to that. Yes, people have agendas. We should realize, however, he says, to finish, that such reserve may exact a practical and educational toll. As awareness of certain values and their place within halacha may become jaded, we become too computerized, too technical, not aware of these bigger subjective pictures. Be that as it may, we can recognize the position of the human and social factor in the halachic decision as firmly secure. And were visible evidence necessary, surely the two greatest poskim of our generation, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, are prime exemplars. These people knew about the objectivity of psak, which they reached with great chidush, but they also knew about the subjectivity of application and how to apply that in very specific circumstances. I'll end with a story. Rabbi Kimchi told me once, he was a shamash to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach for many years in the 70s, early 80s. He drove him around, he sat with him. A doctor once came to them very late in the evening, knocked on the door, a secular doctor from a hospital, from a mental health institution, maybe it was Kfar Shaul, one of those, and said to Rav Shlomo Zalman, I have a major shaila. What is it? He said, we just sedated a man who came in displaying major psychological symptoms, and he's now lying sedated, in the side of a cell, a padded cage, whatever it is. But the guy said to us, he's one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim. Just before we sedated him, he said he's one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim. And said the secular doctor, and I sedated him, but then I suddenly had a panic, and I said, what if he is one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim? How can I tell the difference between someone with psychological trauma and one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim? Because if he is one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim, we're not going to sedate him. And Rav Shlomo Zalman had to kind of look at the case, look at the person, look at the doctor, look at the situation, etc. You can't just look this up in Shulchan Aruch and say, like, where's the chapter on who is and who isn't one of the Lamed Vav Sadiqim? You need to apply enormous amounts of knowledge and understanding, and also, direct focus on the individual. Okay, so I apologize if that was a little bit theoretical, but it's foundations that we'll need. And next week we'll go into the more practical and fascinating world of Beged Ish. See you then, Ezrat Hashem. You can decide what to wear when you come to the shir. Okay.